All right, so we're starting on time. Jerry.
Dolores.
The wonders never cease. All right, so we're starting on time. During our meditation, there may be some slight activity because the crew is trying to get us the computer because we'll need it late in this class. I think that'll be successful. If they're not, we'll move over to room 31 at the very end of class for a short video segment. I wrote a lot of notes to not forget anything, so I'm going to actually refer to notes a little bit. So first of all, what is the mission of this class? As I see it, consciousness class is about becoming more conscious of our inner world, that is how we work, and becoming more conscious of the outer world, that is how the world works. So in each class, we'll start out with some meditation, a little bit of instruction, a little bit of practice in exploring and understanding and modulating our inner reality. And then, depending on the class, we'll either continue with that or we'll look outward at various things that are happening in the society, in the world, in the universe. So that's what the class is all about, inner and outer consciousness, just becoming more aware of who we are and what this is. The goal of more consciousness is more ability to use consciousness, to be more effective in life and to appreciate life more. So we're trying to save the world here. Right, so another way to look at mindfulness. Your attention is a stage. And on that stage is the play of your life experience. The players are your thoughts, your feelings, and your sensations. So your attention is different than the players. Your attention is the stage on which the players play. So your thoughts, your feelings, and your sensations are what your attention is noticing. Now, when you sit in meditation and you close your eyes, typically the lighting is very poor on the stage. When you're first learning to meditate, pretty much there's no light on the stage. You just close your eyes and you go to sleep for 10 minutes, and then Spencer's voice wakes you up. You know, that's good because at least you're relaxing. So that's the beginning of the process. But after a while, after you practice a little while, the lights come up on the stage. And then it gets very interesting because you're watching the show of you. The tendency is to get too involved. That's okay when the show's a comedy, but when the show's it turns tragic, you know, when there's worries, when there's real difficulties, you have a tendency to over-identify with the stuff on the stage. You forget you're in the audience and it rips you up. The trick of mindfulness, the attempt of mindfulness is an attempt to be involved but not too involved. Identified with but not too identified with that play. So that the play affects you. It brings you to life. It's involving, enjoyable. But it's not defining of your reality completely. So the idea is you have to remember that you're in the audience. Okay? You have to remember that you're sitting watching the play. And even though it's a wonderful play or a terrible play or whatever it is, it's just a play. So keep, the way they say it in mindfulness circles is keep your seat. Now, the temptation is to want, because you are the author of this play and the director of this play, as well as being all the, or some of the players in this play, the tendency is to want to get up out of the audience all the time and go, no, you move over here, you stop those lines. Don't get up out of the audience. Now, can you ever get up out of the audience? Yes. When you're really conscious, when you're really aware that what's going on stage just doesn't ring true, and that you could rewrite a line or redirect an actor a little bit to make it work better, then you can go, okay, everybody, hold on. Okay, you move over here, you say these lines, you do this differently, then go back to the audience. So it is possible to occasionally, consciously redirect some of these things. But if you do that habitually, you're not watching a play, you're on stage being part of the play. Okay? All right, so let's practice being in this play. What I just told you is a bunch of lovely ideas. What's going to actually happen in these 10 minutes? People are going to come wandering in, they're going to fix the computer, all kinds of stuff is going to happen. People who just came in, if you close the doors, that would be fantastic. Okay? So that we can meditate quietly for a moment.
Could you say something more about that specific point where you're sitting in the audience and you're observing the play and you feel a clarity, impulse to then get up out of your seat and do something? Could you say something more about that particular point?
Don't get up out of your seat without contemplating that action. If it becomes clear that you need to take that action, then take it very consciously. But don't take it impulsively. Don't take it immediately. Don't take it automatically. All right, now that kind of everybody's here, I will make my little, I feel like a teacher. It's gonna be on time, okay? Please be on time, because otherwise we can't get started on time. And I got feedback from a lot of people about last term, and thank you, it was helpful feedback. But the thing that was most often mentioned that people would like to see better is better time management. That means we start at 10:15. Now, that doesn't mean you can't come in late. Things happen, just come in quietly when you come in late. But please plan to be here at 10:15. Okay, so what's going to happen when we sit and meditate now? First of all, you can do any kind of meditation you want. This is only suggestion. But the operational definition of all this play stuff I just talked about is relax, breathe, keep returning attention to your breathing. Let everything else be just as it is. It's going to be sounds, thoughts, feelings. Just keep coming back to your breathing. As you come back to your breathing, you automatically come out of absorption in these things, because when you pay attention to your breathing, it's like taking a step back. And then you're going to start thinking instantly, and you're going to go like this again. But just breathe, take a step back. So you're returning attention to your breathing over and over again, and you're letting yourself relax on every level as you become aware of contraction or tension. You're just allowing it to release. You're doing two things at the same time. You're relaxing and opening up, you're softening and opening, and at the same time, you're becoming aware of your breathing and whatever else is happening. So you become more and more relaxed and more aware. Let's try that for 10 minutes. If you're going to talk, you guys can do it right. Thank you, Israel. Okay, so not only are they trying to save us, but I'm giving them a hard time. All right, so here we go. We'll sit for 10 minutes. The bell will ring in 10 minutes. Probably in about 5 minutes, my voice will pipe up and say, "Are you aware of your breathing, or are you lost in thought?" Don't try to do anything. Let everything be just as it is. Don't make any attempt at all. Just keep coming back to your breathing and letting yourself soften and open. Include all that you're experiencing in your experience. Just relax and breathe. not built in a day. Your brain isn't rewiring itself instantly. Well, it is, but it's also rewiring itself progressively. So instead of judging yourself for not having become enlightened in the last 10 minutes, or having not been very present in the last 10 minutes, just realize that this is, it's called practice. And if you practice a little bit every day, what was difficult gets a lot easier and a lot richer. Also, I want to comment again that this is a large group of people, and boy, it is peaceful in here. I don't think the normal group of people would be quite this focused. especially when we have a little sensory input. Okay, while we're on this subject of mindfulness, I just very briefly wanted to go over that which I had as an optional handout, and you can get it later if you didn't get it when you came in. What I did is I wrote something called Some Brain and Body Benefits of Mindfulness, and what this came from was on Tuesday night, after I got home from my class, I got an email from somebody saying, "Help, I got a Friday morning presentation on mindfulness. I don't know anything about it. Can you tell me what the, can you summarize the literature on the benefits of mindfulness?" Oh, on the physiological, medical benefits, physiological benefits of mindfulness. And my week has been rich. So in the middle of the night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, of course, my brain started working, and I got up and I wrote this stuff down. And the next morning before my hike, I typed it in and sent it out and made 200 copies of it and hoped that I wasn't going to be horribly embarrassed by what I'd written in my stupor. But this is what I wrote, and at this point, it's okay. So I'll just go over it really quickly, just to give you some feeling for what's going on in that little 10-minute period when you sit, or however 5 minutes, however many minutes you sit. This is not the psychological benefits. This is the physiological benefits. Okay? There's a whole bunch of psychological benefits, which we talk about, and I will talk about. But this is some of the research on the physiology of mindfulness. People are getting it, I guess. You probably need to make enough coffee. This is not Jung's red book, believe me. This is the midnight ramblings of okay, so anyway. Here, just very quickly, just to give you some idea of what, first of all, there's a huge amount of research into mindfulness, and these days you have to be physiological about anything, so a lot of this mindfulness research has to do with hooking people up to various brain scanning machines, and you can see very subtle changes in the brain. So pretty much, if I told you to think of something sad, and we looked at your brain, there would be a shift to your right prefrontal cortex in terms of activation. Now, if I told you a joke, that would be shifted to the left. So the brain is very responsive. It's constantly changing. And so it's not unusual to find brain changes. So some of these brain changes that are being found in this research won't turn out to be especially significant, but they certainly are there. And at this point, they're bolstering the argument that mindfulness should be something that everybody does. I have a lot of extra sheets in case. If we run out, I have more, so come at the end. Okay. All right, so mindfulness steadies attention, improves concentration and working memory. Obviously, you're learning to pay attention. So what happens is your brain gets better at paying attention. As attention gets steadier. This is important for people with ADD or ADHD because their attention is all over the place, and many of us are undiagnosed ADD. Because we went to school before they diagnosed everybody. Thank God, we'd all be on Ritalin, you know. Adderall, Remy. So anyway, the point is, if your brain is all heck over the place, this steadies your attention. Improves your concentration. That is, you can think things through. You can keep your mind on a subject longer. This has to do with the prefrontal cortex and the anterior cingulate cortex. Places in the front top of your brain. Okay? And working memory. It helps you keep stuff in memory. Not long-term memory. What did my aunt do 3 years ago? But what did I learn 2 seconds ago? What was that person's name that I just met? You know, that's short-term working memory, and this certainly helps short-term working memory. Lowers heart rate, lowers blood pressure. This is a fairly dramatic effect of mindfulness, and it's why medical people are so high on telling you to go be mindful, because it really is good for lowering lowering blood pressure and lowering racing heart rate or terribly uneven heart rate. It's even being investigated with things like atrial fib. And circulating stress hormones. This is very good for lowering the level of cortisol in your blood, as one person who's sitting in this class has told me happened very dramatically for him. So circulating stress hormones are things like cortisol, but they're also things like adrenaline. So this will lower the circulating adrenaline level. Boosts immune functioning. We know that stress lowers the functioning of your immune system, and that depression lowers the functioning of your immune system. That is, it hurts your immune system. We don't, at this point, know whether you can become super immune. Whether doing everything right will make you better than normal at immunity. We just know how you get worse than normal. So this takes you from too stressed out to not so stressed out, therefore your immune system recovers. Takes you from too depressed and anxious to not so depressed and anxious, at least. And so this helps your immune system function the way it should. Again, whether you can train your immune system to function better than it normally does is still an open question. But at least this helps your immune system not be compromised. Improves self-control and emotional regulation by better connecting the prefrontal cortex, the part of your mind that's the thinking part, with the limbic system, the part of your mind that's the emotional and motivational part. So what it does is it makes more connections, and it makes more regulation by the front of your mind of the middle of your mind. So this is why when you're not sure what you're feeling and you're really upset, if you can label your feeling, it helps you feel more in control and less upset. Because the connections between the front of your mind and the middle of your mind are working, and they tamp the overactivity of the middle of your mind, especially the amygdala, which is the alarm system. So you get better able to control how you function, and better able to deal with your feelings and not have them be out of control. Decreases impulsive behavior and can reverse addiction. Again, the middle of your mind is where motivation comes from. So when you want to drink and you don't think about it, the next thing you know, you're having a drink. But if the top of your mind is engaged, it goes, wait a minute, maybe that's not the best solution to stress, is to do that. Maybe you should call somebody up instead. So what happens is you engage the motivational center with the judgment center, the prefrontal cortex, and you're less likely to do impulsive things that you'll later regret. This has been for some time a treatment of choice for people with severe addictions, not just the usual addictions, but with heroin addiction, meth addiction, crack cocaine addiction. They're using mindfulness to help people watch the impulse move through them and shake them, and then subside like a wave. And every time you decouple the impulse from the action, you know, the minute you have an impulse, you take an action. That's typical. But if you can feel the impulse to smoke that cigarette and watch it go through you and watch what it does to you, then it will subside very quickly. And every time you let that impulse go through without acting on it, you weaken that link. So you lessen the addiction. Calms anxiety immediately and long term. calms anxiety immediately because you're relaxing at that moment. You're paying attention to your breathing. You're letting go of the of being on the stage with the thoughts that are causing you to be anxious. So in the short term, anxiety goes down. And in the long term, the whole system becomes less aroused and less easily perturbed. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy helps alleviate or eliminate depression. Your self-talk has a huge amount to do with how you feel. If you keep telling yourself everything is terrible, you're terrible, it's never going to get better, you're going to get depressed. But how, we're not even aware of our thoughts, no less monitoring them. When you become mindful, you become aware of what you're saying to yourself, and you then can take, you can get up out of the audience very consciously, go up on stage and say, "You, I want you to change your line. Don't tell me all the time that I'm bad. Why don't you tell me all the time that I'm good and learning?" Okay, so you get back in the audience, and the next time the actor screws up and starts to say, "Oh, you're such a stupid person," then you say, "No, that's not your line." And after a while, what happens is we see a significant improvement in depression, and for some people, elimination of it. And mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is only one such approach. There are other approaches, things like acceptance and commitment therapy, other approaches that are being developed, which work basically the same way. Gary?
Can you say a little more about cognitive therapy, what it amounts to?
Yeah, the short answer to cognitive therapy is pay attention to your thoughts, register or write down the ones that are unduly negative and unrealistic, like, "Oh God, the world is so terrible," or, "Oh God, I have no love ever any," write those down and then correct them. So cognitive therapy is just be aware of your thoughts, notice the ones that are unduly negative and unrealistic, and correct them to become more positive and realistic. So you're not going to tell yourself everything is wonderful all the time, you won't believe that. But at least you can tell yourself the truth instead of a catastrophe. That's cognitive therapy. And if you do nothing else but that, you'll save yourself. There's a lot of data that shows that cognitive therapy works as well or better than medication for a whole host of things that we're over-medicating people for. By the way, I would not suggest throwing away your pills. I would suggest doing these kinds of mindfulness and cognitive therapy and stuff like that with hand in hand with your pills, so eventually you can let your pills go as you train your brain to work differently.
My pills don't help me. It's like finding out you're kind people again.
Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't do. But what you do is you reach out to people, that's why I'm happy about you, is because you're a social creature. You reach out when you have need, right?
Yeah, I get quiet when I call early, like I called you early one time you got mad at me.
I wouldn't doubt it, but I don't get mad at you, really. I just kind of off by you later.
this early you were just waking up, right?
Sometimes they never wake up. Okay, let's keep going. How are we doing?
31, ready.
31's written, but what about this one? Because we're still trying. Good. Because this is too many people for 31. So we're going to keep trying this.
All right. We're going to make a little noise, though.
That's good. That's good. Helps manage chronic pain. Look, pain is like this. Chronic pain is not going to go away. The question is whether you focus only on the chronic pain, and then the pain becomes your whole reality. Or to take a step back and realize, yeah, there's a lightning storm over there, it's always going to be there, but there's a heck of a lot else happening in my consciousness besides that. So this is widening your perspective. It's being used all over the place for chronic pain treatment. It used to be we used dissociative strategies, try to get people not to think about it, but it's hard when you're hurt not to think about it. Now we say, okay, like include this, but don't become narrowed onto it. Retards or prevents thinning of the cerebral cortex with age. This is new research. It's not yet set in stone. But it appears that what happens is the top part of the brain, the cerebral cortex, thins with age. And that has something to do with age-related cognitive decline. you have less gray matter up there, you lose some function as you age. It appears that mindfulness practitioners can slow or even stop that process, at least in the parts of the brain that have been looked at. And there are some important parts of the brain, the prefrontal cortex and the insula, which has to do with your sense of self and your monitoring of your internal state. These are important parts of the brain, and preliminary research shows that in meditators, these parts thin more slowly or don't thin. That's Sarah Lazar at Harvard Medical School is continuing to do research on this. Okay. May slow age-related cognitive decline for that same reason. It may be that we can slow the process of cortical thinning down or even arrest it. It may slow aging in general by preserving the integrity of telomeres at the ends of chromosomes. One way to look at one perspective on aging is that at the ends of our chromosomes, we have these protective caps called telomeres. And they, as they degrade with insult, the very things that happen as you go through your life, as those the ends of those chromosomes degrade, then that promotes aging. Especially stress seems to be injurious to the telomeres and accelerates aging. So the question is, if you were less stressed, would you age less quickly? And the answer to that is pretty clearly yes, and probably it has something to do with the telomeres, or certainly it has something to do with the telomeres. The question is, could you stop or reverse aging if you were entirely unstressed and even blissful? And so this is just this is the one that I had the most trouble kind of putting down because I thought this is kind of the most controversial. But it's clear that stress is injurious, and that or too much stress is injurious. And mindfulness helps you modulate your stress level, so it's obviously going to be helpful to slow the injury process, the aging process that too much stress would bring on. That's a really lightning dash through some of the physiological research on mindfulness. Any quick questions before we go from that? Because that was just preamble, actually. That's not what our class is today. Okay, so let's see. Chris and then Donna. Okay, Chris.
I'm just worried about the more information about the telomeres.
Okay, so I couldn't put all the references down. The best way to do this, if you want the most current information, you go to scholar.google.com. It's Google Scholar. Scholar.google.com. And if you're interested in a particular thing, like mindfulness and telomeres, you just type in the search bar, mindfulness telomeres, and up come all the articles. And then you can go and you can see. There's so much. It would be also, this would be a 20-page document for the references. I don't want to do that. So scholar-google.com, but if there's one particular one you're interested in, come up and see me, because I do have some references handy. By no means have I read all the references. Donna.
It seems like a lot of these benefits accrue because you come to live more mindfully. So it has to do with the lesson you learn in meditation, which is to live mindfully. But, so, I mean, I'm asking, is this meditation or is this mindful living?
Okay. It's both. Even if you don't think about mindfulness for any but the 10 minutes a day that you do it, it still will have benefit. But what happens, obviously, is that people start to live more mindfully. They start to pause every once in a while and become present and let go of stress and breathe. And so this starts to become something that you practice as you move through your life. And then obviously the benefits become more because you're practicing it longer. So at the beginning, it's just a little seed you plant, and then the seed grows into a way of being. Okay, let's leave this now because I have a lesson. First, if you haven't registered for the class yet, it would be nice to do that because it pays for this thing we got here. So please go do that. And If you haven't registered, you can sign in on the sign-in sheet by just printing your name, and then I'm going to reprint that for next week, because there will be some people that haven't registered yet that will register. As long as I'm doing this. Anybody, this is Michael Hegelwald, where are you? Okay, this Michael records all our classes, and they are available. So if you miss a class, you can go to swt.org, swt.org/Spencer. And you can find most anything there. swt.org/Spencer. And that's courtesy of Robert, okay, who's not here right now. Okay. But so that's Robert Bernstein's website. If you go here, swt.org/Spencer, our class will come up. If you want much more information on mindfulness and want, in fact, a 17-minute guided relaxation with music and mindfulness session, go to my website. And it'll say guided relaxation mindfulness. You can just click on that and you can go through this beautiful music I found. Lovely 17-minute letting go of stress, relaxing, and becoming mindful. Also, if you go to my old, drspencersherman.com, if you go to my old website, on the front page of the new website, it will say, click here to go to my old website. My old website has lots of audio files and lots of everything else, and a whole book on mindfulness, so there's tons of stuff on mindfulness there. Drspencersherman.org, or you can just do spencersherman.org, gets there. Okay, all classes. This is all winter classes, so if anybody wants the MP3 file of every class, you get it. Life story books? Yes?
You wrote com, but you said or.
It's dot com. It's dot com. This is a Robert site, that's dot org, but I'm dot com. Life stories. We'll do that. We'll do that after, right at the end. Okay, what's up and coming? Morty, yeah.
If Robert's not here, does that mean today's the best not getting done?
No, it's being taped. He can hear it because it's being taped. It'll be put up on swt.org so that Robert can listen to it as well as any of the rest of you. Okay, what's upcoming? I have an embarrassment of riches in terms of everybody that I asked that I thought wasn't going to come said they were, so I'm actually having four guests. Next week is Alice Aldridge, who is an emeritus professor of marine biology at UCSB and is the person around whom the Open Door Sangha has revolved for many years. She's been studying mindfulness for a long time, studies with Jack Kornfield at Spirit Rock, and I asked her to come teach us about metta, M-E-T-T-A. In Buddhism, there are basically two kinds of meditation. There's mindfulness, which we study, and there's metta, which I haven't taught you much of yet. And I thought, why should I do that when Alice is the person to do that? So next week will be, she's going to bring us through the theory and practice, the experience of metta meditation. I'm very happy that she's going to come. She's wonderful. Go to google.com and let's see what happens.
Who's the other Grace paper?
Rock and roll.
Where would you like to go?
Where we're going to go is YouTube.
Okay.
YouTube.com.
I just figured while I'm here, let's make sure it's
okay. And will it be? Will you get to? Will we get to have audio? Bill Monroe, absolutely.
reconcile with the church. So we should. All right, so we're checking that out. Okay, back to this. Okay.
Well, who are the other three speakers?
I'm going to tell you in a second. I just want to make sure we have audio as well as video.
Oh, okay.
I can't get live through this.
Yay!
You!
Are you our good to go, sir?
Thank you. Thank everybody. You guys, you're the best. All right, so forget Bill Monroe here. I got to. What am I going to do? I'm going to go like this. Okay. Right. You get to see the thing there. All right, I keep that up there because otherwise the thing has to go up and has to go down. All right, so that's next week. The week after, I invited Michael Gilbert to come to class. Michael Gilbert taught at the for 5 minutes at the end of our last class. He's the evolutionary psychologist. Wrote the book The Disposable Man. And I asked him to come back and teach us evolutionary psychology. Because I thought, why should I try to do that when he's got, on the back of that book, The Disposable Male, he has the three preeminent people in the world in evolutionary psychology saying how good the book is. So why don't I get the expert here? So Michael's going to come back and do that. By the way, he's all...
What does it mean, evolutionary psychology?
It means why we do everything that we do. It's because it had a payoff in terms of survival and procreation. Evolutionary psychologists look at the world through the lens of what payoff did this have such that it has persisted in terms of our lives. You know, how has this been an evolutionary advantage? For example, why do we wear clothes? Because it helps survival and maybe not procreation, but it helps survival. If we don't wear clothes in environments that are challenging, we tend not to survive. So that's why around the world, in most environments, people wear clothes.
Does he also get into...
Michael, right?
Yes, very good. Does he also delve into how some cultures have certain habits and other cultures have more successful habits and become more successful over the long term?
I'm sure he does. Ask him. He's the expert. Oh, also, if you're really interested in this, he's teaching a course at Adult Ed this term on evolutionary psychology. His name is Michael Gilbert. Okay, I don't know where that course is. I didn't search it. But Betsy?
It's at Wade Center, room 20 at 7:15.
In what? On what? Tuesday night, 7:15. Well, what's it called?
Darwin, the story.
View your world through Darwin's eyes. Okay, so if you haven't registered, you can do that through the second week. Register for that. He's profound. Okay, so he's coming in 2 weeks to teach us evolutionary psychology, which is absolutely great. Okay, and then in 3 weeks, Dave Rico is going to come.
All right!
Okay, and he does whatever he wants. Said he would like to do is treat all the world's great questions like, is there a God? Why is there evil? Stuff like that. But he wants to treat them from the point of view of the heart rather than the head. He said these are questions that you can't answer intellectually, but the answers come on deeper levels. So that's what he's going to do.
If he wrote this book.
I think it's going to be his next book. I mean, what he does is he uses us, see. He works on it. Every year he does another book. You know, he's getting more and more famous. And he does another book every year, and he kind of prototypes it here. Sees whether what'll float. So I expect your critical attention. Yeah. All right. And then I'm going to teach a class, and then Jonathan Young is going to come. Jonathan Young... worked with Joe Campbell late in his life and established the Joseph Campbell Library and Archives at Pacifica, and has been teaching mythology for a long time. Jonathan has his own Center for Story and Symbol, where he lectures on mythology. He's really a great presenter. I'm taking continuing education from him. It was amongst the highlights of the best continuing education I've ever taken. He's fascinating. So he's going to come, and I said, Jonathan, what do you want to talk about? And he said, I don't know, what do you want me to talk about? And I said, well, tell us why myth is important. Tell us stuff that we don't know that will fascinate us. And he said, sure. So he's going to come in about 5 weeks, and I'm going to teach the last two classes. And I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet, but I'll probably take you through an experience. Because I like to do one experience.
Free class, you're going to teach, you're going to take us through experience. Free class, you're going to teach, right?
The last three classes. I'm going to teach three classes, yeah. But I think the last two classes will do an experience.
How about the third class, the first class?
I don't know yet. I'm not sure yet. Okay, so let's keep going, because I have a lesson here that I want to do. Okay, I'll be part of the lesson. Okay, Mind Supermind on Friday night, April 25th, Veronica Goodchild, who teaches at Pacifica, is going to be talking about her experience of walking part of the Camino de Santiago, the pilgrimage route in France and Spain. She's going to talk about walking part of that and what it brought up for her as a Jungian. She's a Jungian psychologist. So that's for $5 here on Friday, April 25th.
Okay. 7:30.
It might be 7 o'clock. Last time I got here at 7 o'clock to be the gracious host and make sure everything was all right, and they were waiting for me. So it might be 7 to 9. You got to look. Okay. Okay, Dave Cumes, many of you know who Dave Cumes is. He's going to be teaching a class in this room tomorrow from 10 to 1 called Wilderness Rapture and Inner Healing. Wilderness Rapture and Inner Healing.
What does that mean?
It means that Wilderness Rapture means when you go out in nature, something can happen to you. And part of it has to do with healing.
Oh. Right?
Okay. All right. So, announcements. We're going to have announcements on. You can put flyers on the table, or announcements will happen at the very end, 11:45. Also, art. If you want to bring in art and show it, and the life story stuff will happen 11:45. Your comments. If you're going to make comments, either stand up, we'll make them loud because people can't hear, or you can use the microphone. But it's important for people to hear what other people say. So if we have commentary or questions and people can't hear, raise your hand if you can't hear, and then we'll give people the microphone and we'll tell them to yell. Okay. Science's three great miracles. That's the next thing.
What was that?
Science's three great miracles. And that's just a note to myself, but it's a good way to start this. I don't want to detract from the miracles that we learned about when we grew up. You know, the Red Sea parting and walking on the water and loaves and fishes. And you know, I don't want to take anything away from that. But if you really get into science, the miracles that you learn about in science kind of make those miracles kind of pale. Well, first of all, if you're a scientist, you think, well, did the Red Sea really part, or was there a really low tide? And they got wet, you know. But even if you don't suppose the intervention of the supernatural into the natural world, and just look at the natural world, what you see is it just takes your breath away and stuns you. So I just want to talk about three of the great miracles that I see as a scientifically trained person. The first is all this, the structure of the universe. You know, the universe isn't this room, and the universe isn't even this earth. If you look big, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the scale of it is so beyond belief. It's just so mind-boggling that once you understand what the scale of it is, when you look up at the stars at night, you have a mystical experience. You're not looking at a two-dimensional thing. You're looking at, oh my God, that's 25, that's 10, the moon is 10 times the circumference of the Earth, I can see that. Then there's Jupiter, that's 2,000 times further than the moon. The nearest, the stars that I can see there, they're 20,000 times further than Jupiter, the center of the galaxy. You just keep looking out and you see how big it is, how complex it is, how much energy is involved in things. And it just completely, everything you read about black holes and it stuns you. What they're talking about is so beyond comprehension, so enormous. I just read something the other day about neutrinos, which I'm going to tell you a tiny bit about. When supernova collapse, you know, when enormous stars collapse, they send out a tremendous amount of energy you can see across the universe. 99% of the energy that they send out, most of the energy is captured because everything is kind of sucked in. 99% of the energy they send out is neutrino energy. And it goes out across the universe, and this enormous star collapses. And that's that burst of neutrino energy. It takes 10 seconds for that energy to be released into the universe. 10 seconds. Can you imagine how much energy that is being pouring out? Anyway, a little bit more about the structure of the universe. We're obviously going to look at this over and over again. But just to give you some idea of the scale of things, and some of you have heard me say this before, but I'll say it not as quickly as I'm saying. If the Earth is the size of between a pinhead and a pinpoint, so barely visible size. Okay, here's the Earth, a little bit bigger than a pinhead. A foot away, here's the Sun, the size of a small thumbtack, like a pencil eraser head. Okay, so a pencil eraser head is the Sun. The Earth is a barely visible speck a foot away. How close is the next nearest eraser head? The next nearest one, Proxima Centauri, 4.2 light years away. How far is it on this scale? 50 miles to the next eraser head, the next closest one. And that's the stuff that's really, really close to us. So the scale of things is boggles the mind. And that's it looking big. Then if you look small, you find equally ridiculously unbelievable things about the structure of the universe. So the more you learn about the structure of the universe, the more it seems like it's a miracle. It's just incomprehensibly wonderful. Len.
So there's a wonderful exhibit at the Museum of Natural History in New York that demonstrates this whole thing. There's a 12-story sphere, and then they'll put a tennis ball next to it. That's the relationship of the Earth to the Sun. But then they can take it to a micro level and talk about the distance of the electron in relationship to the nucleus. So it's a great exhibit.
At the Museum of Natural History.
Yeah, I found
that
with my friend
Joe. I don't want to go too deeply into this because I have a lot of ground covered. Nancy.
I just wanted to comment on what you're speaking to on Sunday nights at Channel 11. There's a program called Cosmos.
Cosmos.
And it speaks to all of us.
Yeah. Many of you know that Cosmos is the new iteration of. What was it called?
Cosmos.
it was called Cosmos before. What's it? It's Sagan, yeah, but is the new one also called Cosmos? So it's Cosmos 2, okay? Okay, and that's Neil deGrasse Tyson, right?
Yes.
Okay, so that's the first great miracle is the universe. And of course, then the questions come up like, where did this come from? You know, what's the history of the universe? How did it evolve? Second great miracle is out of all this stuff, life happened somehow. Somehow this stuff decided to take on a life of its own and start eating the rest of the stuff. And somehow things that didn't care started to care. and started to want to stay together and to replicate themselves and to fight against entropy. So the second great question is, how out of the inertness of the universe came something which, in a sense, counters the direction of the universe toward greater disorganization? Because life is an organizing, self-organizing force. So how did it happen? That this fundamentally different thing arose out of this strata. Okay. And then the third,
context being consciousness is the base of all things.
No, wait, I'm getting there. Okay. And then the third great question is how is it that we're sitting here understanding all this stuff? How did life develop not just a sense of what to go toward to eat and what to go away from to not get eaten, approach, avoid? How did that so rapidly develop into the universe of ideas that we each have and share? It's like there's a whole different universe that arose orthogonally to the universe that we live in. A whole separate universe, a universe of consciousness. How did that happen? That rocks gave birth to protozoans who gave birth to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. I mean, it's just like a whole... It's like existence took a left turn, you know, in consciousness. Now, it may turn out that consciousness is more than an orthogonal to the universe. It may be substantial to the universe. But that's another question. All right, so having said that, and thrown away most of the lecture, which I will get to in about 4 weeks, which I'll get, don't worry, I won't let anything slide. But what I want to do now is show you three short videos that kind of hang together and kind of underline what I just said. Okay? So that's what I want to do next, to show you three very short YouTube videos, which, well, you'll see. So we need to have the room made into appropriate for video.
Make it dark.
Yeah, that's what we got. Are we ready to go? All the switches were down and the lights were still on. Some of them are cross-wired. Okay, so here goes.
Astronomers in 1996 attempted to do something extraordinary. They pointed the Hubble Space Telescope into a part of the sky that seemed utterly empty, a patch devoid of any planets, stars, and galaxies. This area was close to the Big Dipper, a very familiar constellation, and the patch of sky was no bigger than a grain of sand held out at arm's length. This was a somewhat risky move by the scientists. After all, observing time on this telescope is in very high demand, and some questioned whether it would be wasted trying to look at nothing. There was a real risk that the images returned would be as black as the space at which it was being pointed. Nevertheless, they opened the telescope and slowly, over the course of 10 full days, photons that had been traveling for over 13 billion years finally ended their journey on the detector of humanity's most powerful telescope, their feeble signals collected almost one by one. When the telescope was finally closed and the images were processed, the light from over 3,000 galaxies had covered the detector, producing one of the most profound and humbling images in all of human history. Every single spot, smear, and dot was an entire galaxy, and each one containing hundreds of billions of stars. Later, in 2004, they did it again, this time pointing the telescope towards an area near the constellation Orion. They opened the shutter for over 11 days and 400 complete orbits around the Earth, using detectors with increased sensitivity and filters that allowed more light through than ever before. Over 10,000 galaxies appeared in what became known as the Ultra Deep Field, an image that represented the farthest we've ever seen into the universe. The photons from these galaxies left when the universe was only 500 million years old. And 13 billion years later, they end their long journey as a small blip on a telescope CCD. These galaxies, while standing absolutely still, are racing away from us, in some cases, faster than the speed of light. The space-time between us and everything else grows larger by the minute, pushing the galaxies in this image to a distance of over 47 billion light years. And because of universal expansion, the farther something is away from us, the more its light is shifted toward the red and the faster it appears to be moving. Edwin Hubble himself discovered this by measuring the redshift of many galaxies, and it's a measure of not only speed, but distance as well. Recently, Hubble scientists put the icing on the cake. Using the measured redshifts of all the galaxies inside the image, they made a 3D model of the ultra-deep field. This is how it looks when we apply the distances of the galaxies in the most important image ever taken. There are over 100 billion galaxies in the universe. Simply saying that number doesn't really mean much to us because it doesn't provide any context. Our brains have no way to accurately put that in any meaningful perspective. When we look at this image, however, and think about the context of how it was made, and really understand what it means, we instantly gain the perspective and cannot help but be forever changed by it. We pointed the most powerful telescope ever built by human beings at absolutely nothing, for no other reason than because we were curious, and discovered that we occupied a very tiny place in the heavens.
Okay, so wait, I gotta turn the light for just a second, then I'll show you the next one, but I gotta show you something. Okay, so look over here for just a second, and I have fun facts for the day, one of which I might not get to, so I'll get to it later, but this is a fun fact for the day.
You're racing over here.
It's on the other board. Okay, yeah. So if you want to know, here's something for your... next dinner table conversation, you can say, did you know how big the universe is? So at this point, we can see 47 billion light years in each direction. Okay, so it's twice that. So it would be 94 billion light years in diameter. 47 billion light years is, okay, so 47 billion That's the light years. Now, each light year is 6 trillion miles. So we have to add 6 trillion to this. So let's see, we're going to go 1,000, million, billion, trillion miles. And 6 times 47 is approximately 300. So that's how many miles is the radius of the universe from us. And it goes out far in the other direction. I hope I did that right. But I think I did. If any nerds out there can tell me they have 3/4 zeros or subtract. So that's the size of the universe. I'll give you another fun fact. There are little particles called neutrinos, which are almost massless and travel at almost the speed of light and are produced by supernova, by the Big Bang itself, and especially by the nuclear fusion in the sun. And these neutrinos are traveling all throughout the universe. And right now, as you sit there in your seat, this number of neutrinos is going through you. What's the number of neutrinos going through you? 100, oh, 1 quadrillion. Okay.
1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000
every second. So that's why you feel a little weird sometimes. All right, enough of this. We got to go back to the next one.
Dear fellow citizen, one man has uncovered a surprising device that has grocery stores running scared. From this distant vantage point, the Earth might not seem of any particular interest. But for us, it's different. Consider again that butt. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors, so that in glory and triumph they had become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is no nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species can migrate. Visit us? Yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experiment. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human disease than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the only home we've ever known. The little blue dot.
So I'm going to do, I'm going to do one more, and then we'll have a little time to, just a couple of minutes to talk about this. Now you'll see that there is a progression in these three videos that they actually make an argument, okay, put together. See around us is built on a story. Every culture has a different set of answers to these basic questions of who are you? What is it to be a human being? What's important? What's valuable? Where do we come from? Where are we going? How does the world work? Every culture answers this in a different way. And science provides some answers. It says basically that what you are is a discrete, separate individual among other individuals in a universe that's separate from you as well. And every field has agreed with this characterization of what it is to exist. Psychology, or this bubble of psychology, or this mind encased in flesh. Religion, you are a soul encased in flesh. Physics, you're a mass subject to impersonal forces that are deterministic. Biology, you are basically a flesh robot programmed by your genes to maximize reproductive self-interest. Economics, you are a rational actor seeking to maximize financial self-interest. All of them would be on what it was to exist. Well, the new sciences contradict that. Quantum mechanics seems to violate the separation between self and other. If we're separate from the universe, then of course we want to control these indifferent or hostile external forces, and humanity's destiny becomes to become the lords and masters of nature and to transcend nature. And it's not working too well anymore. In economics, that translates into growth, the endless growth of the human realm. And we're learning that there's a limit to that, and we're learning that it's not an external universe out there, but that everything we do to this world, we're doing on some level to ourselves. That is a wound that we feel all the time and we suffer from. That pain of existing in our culture that's so omnipresent we don't even realize it, except when we're bored. You know? That feeling of, why does it hurt just to exist? When we're young, we have this knowledge that the world is supposed to be much more beautiful than what has been offered to us as normal. We understand that. But that expectation gets betrayed again and again and again, and to protect it, you develop cynicism. As our ecosystems fall apart, our political system, our educational system, healthcare system falls apart, things aren't working so well anymore, and it's a lot harder to fully believe in our stories. So we're moving into a different story, a
a different story of self, a different story of the world, a different story of people. The self of interconnectedness, the self of inner beings. One thing it means is that these tiny actions may have a significance beyond that we can understand. That logic of the heart that says, yeah, I know that this is a significant act, and I know that everything I do is significant, no longer contradicts the logic of the mind, which had been the logic of separation. And what effect could you, one tiny little being, have with the puny force available to you when the powers that be have so much more force at their disposal? Every act that comes from the understanding of interconnection, of inner being, is a spiritual act and also a political act. By acting from a different story, we disrupt the psychic substructure of our mythology, and we offer an alternative. This is something that's eminently practical. And any time that we give somebody an experience that doesn't fit into the old story, it weakens that old story. It disrupts it. It could be an act of generosity. It could be an act of forgiveness. Anything that violates that understanding that we're separate and everyone's in it for themselves. Being in service to something larger than yourself. And I would offer that as the formula for stepping into the flow of synchronicity. You don't know how to get from here to there, but that thing larger than yourself does. And it arranges these synchronicities, being in the right place at the right time, being in flow. I think everyone's experienced that. Usually when you experience that, it's when your world's kind of falling apart, and you're in the state of uncertainty, and then things start to flow and start to work, right? And we can enter that state when we let go of the paradigm of control and bow into service to this thing larger than ourselves. And what is this thing? What is it that unifies all of these different things that we're committed to? Let's call it the more beautiful world our heart knows is possible. As you go about your life, in fact, right now, feel that part of you that knows that you are here in service, and ask yourself if you're ready to bow more deeply into that service. If you do it, I predict that you will experience an unexpected opportunity to act on that intention, and it'll be just at the edge of your courage, but not past it.
Let's take a few minutes and see what your reactions are to all this loosely made argument. So Michael's the first hand I saw, and then Sarah, and we'll just see what we have in the last couple minutes. Okay, so Michael.
There's a powerful line in a movie called Neighbors, which
where the female lead is the connection. Was the connection between the Earthlings and the new aliens that have arrived. And she's filled with gratitude, and she turns to the alien, the human form, who is General Reeves, and she says, "Thank you so much for helping us save our planet." And a serious look comes on his face, and he turns to her and says, with a great question, "Your planet?" And so it's interesting just to realize we take for granted that we call this our planet.
I'm going to take this around. So,
speak this far away from the microphone is what's best.
My reaction from all this is one of deep emotions. Seeing all these visions, I'm filled with great sadness and at the same moment, great joy, almost bliss.
I agree. I very much agree with that way of thinking. It sets off very powerful things to see these things, yeah? And I guess the great paradox is, on the one hand, the drama that we're playing, I guess we're coming back to stage again, but the drama that we're playing is on such an unimaginably large stage that in one sense, it's absurd to even think about making any difference at all, because it's too big. But on the other hand, what it comes down to is, if you feel something in yourself that's somehow connected to everything else, then it becomes absolutely the center of your life and vitally important to everything, that you act with the impulse that comes through you, that comes from everything and connects to everything. That's what Eisenstein was saying in that last video, that somehow your individual life and what you do is vitally important to the existence and nature of the whole thing. And that even though you're beyond tiny, your importance is one with the whole drama. So it's such a strange feeling.
Well, I remember that video, Conception to Birth, when the cells divide at such a rate that if the heart hadn't started beating, we'd weigh 924 tons when we were born. So clearly the heart energy, the love energy, the heart energy is our connection to self and connection to the universe, it seems to me, because it's where life begins. And so this is all the heart energy finding itself. And the story of separation just happened because of our brain being so amazing and having thought be what we think we are. But like Elizabeth Satoris said, our brains are our second order evolutionary systems and our bodies are our third order. So our bodies are like rainforests and our cells in the brain can just be yes, no. So we have this multiple stem cell body that's self-organizing, that's just like the universe. And so if we can pay attention to it, we can learn how to be in consciousness and blended with it.
The step beyond the separateness that the brain perceives is a further development of the cognitive capacity. Right? And so what happens is you grow your comprehension, your consciousness grows beyond that story of separateness to something that reunites you with what you started from. People that are coming in, you're not coming in. No,
we're not done yet.
So one more person want to comment? So Bill.
I just wanted to make an observation on the last video. So when they showed the groups of people together, it was because of music and how it brought them together and what a strong force that is in the world to bring people together like that. It's music.
And so, more generally, not just music, but art. somehow, you know, the fact that the artists made what we saw that stirred us. So I think that kind of music is probably the most primary art in a certain sense, but there's something about the arts that is not secondary, not frivolous, but is somehow centrally important to human evolution. I think we're going to see the arts move from the periphery to very much the center of our understanding of what moves forward our development. Okay, so I think we have, I don't know what this is all about, but I think we probably have to, I think we probably have to break for today. When you go out of here, go out with a little bit of a sense of the fact that what you do is really important for not only yourself, but for everybody and the whole thing. All right. Okay, oh. Thank you, guys. Folks, we're going to do a little